We are coming back to, what is it, session 7 or 8 or whatever it is, of this Brahmajala Sutta, Brahma's net. And just a quick reminder that what we're doing is we're looking at the various kinds of wrong views in the world, especially views about survival after death and kind of these sort of religious questions. And of these 62 views, quite interesting is that they are divided really into two kinds of views. In the suttas, we often talk about two ways of thinking about survival at death or non-survival, and one is the eternalist view, and one is the annihilationist view. Eternalist view is that you die and then you carry on forever in some kind of happy realm, and of course the annihilationist view is that, that when you die, that's it, it's all finished. So all of these 62 views are really summarized by these two views, annihilation or eternalism. They fall into one category of the other, or the other. And so far we have looked at all the eternalist views, there's about 50 of them altogether, and we have 12 views remaining, which are, at least 7 of those remaining are about annihilationism, and then the 5 last ones are more on the eternalist side again. So we have looked at eternalism, now we're going to look at annihilationism. And the idea here for the Buddha is to grapple with all kinds of views that are possible to make about these things. Yeah, so any view that has an eternalist leaning would then be included in these views presented here. And any view that is annihilationist in nature is included within the annihilationist views. That's why it's called the Brahmajala Sutta, Brahma's net. It's like you catch all of these wrong views about the nature of reality. That's kind of the what is going on here. So this is the sort of the background. So we have so far we have looked at all the eternalist views, or most of them. Now we're going to look at the annihilationist side. And of course, what is interesting about this is that if you look at the history of religion around the world, and you look at the various kinds of views, whether in religion or outside of religion, whether it's kind of modern views that are considered non-religious, or maybe they're not non-religious, I'm not sure, it really depends on how you look at them, they always fall into those categories. If you look aside from Buddhism, and you look at all the religions and philosophies of the world, all the various ideas that people have, they are either eternalist or they are annihilationist. Look at all the large religions of the world, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and many others. They all have the eternalist aspect to them. And then you look at kind of the modern ideas, the more atheistic or agnostic ideas. They tend to be, okay, when you die, that's it, you're finished. And that's the annihilationist side of things. So these ancient views presented by the Buddha, they fit very, very well in with the whole history of religion and philosophical thought. They all tend into those two categories. So Buddhism is really unique, right? It's really special. Doesn't neither eternalist nor annihilationist. This is Buddhism for you. And this is the one thing that makes Buddhism very special. So what is that view which is neither eternalist nor annihilationist? Well, that view is dependent origination. That's what that view is. Things originate depending on causes and conditions. They don't arise out of a vacuum. So eternalism is wrong, because only if something has a cause and conditions in place will it carry on. So eternalism can't be right. Things only carry on because of cause and conditions. And that also means that annihilationism also must be wrong, because if the cause and conditions are in place, then even when you die, it will carry on, because the causes of rebirth are there, part of the your mental makeup, so it carries on into the future. So this is the middle, what is called the, called the middle way, it's called the just by the middle, or middle philosophy or something like that. It's somewhere in between eternalism and annihilationism. And this is what makes Buddhism unique in world history and in world philosophy, that it has this kind of idea, which is just so different from anything else that we are used to. And the only reason why this is the case is because in Buddhism we have this idea of non-self. And this idea of non-self is also unique in world history or religious history. There's nowhere else you find this idea of non-self. Because as long as you have a self there, as long as you have this idea of something being permanent, well, that thing which is permanent, either it carries on forever, because permanent things tend to carry on forever, or in maybe under certain circumstances, they can be annihilated. Yeah, they can disappear. They're permanent for a while, stable for a while, and then bang, they're gone. So that self-view is what drives this distinction between eternalism on the one hand and annihilationism on the one hand. And because Buddhism is pretty much the only place you find this idea of non-self, of non-permanence, there's no permanent essence, it then changes this whole equation, and it sees the continuation of life, the continuation of birth or whatever, it then becomes dependent on cause and conditions, rather than being dependent on some kind of permanent essence inside of us. So this is very fascinating, it kind of ties together the ideas of non-self and dependent origination, and why these views of Uccedavada, Sasadavada, eternalism and annihilationism are, you know, found commonly throughout human history here. Let's have a look at these seven views of annihilationism and see what comes of this, because it is actually quite interesting. Well, I think it's interesting. We'll see whether it really is interesting or not. Depends on your, I guess, proclivities or whatever it is. Here we go. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who are annihilationists. They assert the annihilation, the eradication, and obliteration of an existing being on seven grounds. And what are the seven grounds on which they rely? So, here you have these ascetics and Brahmins. These are like the religious people and the philosophers of the time. And what they do, they assert the annihilation, eradication, and obliteration, just to make absolutely clear what is at stake. Yeah? Kind of make no doubt about it. Obliteration. I like these words are really good. Eradication. And what is eradicated, and this is kind of the main point here, is the idea of an existing being. Sattu, satasa. This is kind of the critical thing there. An existing being means something which is permanent in the suttas, an essential essence of someone. Yeah, this is kind of the critical word here. This is why this is called annihilationism, because an existing entity is being destroyed. This is the idea behind annihilationism. Why do people have these annihilationist views? It's kind of interesting. Where did they come from? Why do people have eternalist views? Well, first of all, it is because of a permanent self, the idea of a permanent self. We feel that we exist, yeah? Most people say, yeah, I exist. If someone says, I'm going to kill you, usually we say, no thanks. No need. Yeah, okay, that's okay. Not now. Yeah, I'm busy. No, we don't want that, because precisely there's a feeling that we exist in a certain way, so we'd rather not die. Yeah, this is kind of fundamental to what it means to be a being. Even animal, even ants, even mosquitoes don't want to die. This kind of drive for existence is very strong. Yeah. So why is there a distinction between eternalism and annihilationism? And very often these philosophical ideas. One of the things that we are seeing in the suttas is how our view ultimately comes down to feelings. Yeah, that is such a fascinating thing. I mentioned this many times now in accordance with the sutta, but it's very fascinating and very interesting. Yeah. The views we have about the world, and especially these kind of religious views, or you might call them existential views, because they are about our existence, they are based on feelings. What feels good to you? That gives an idea where these views come from. So if you really love life, life is wonderful, wow, I can enjoy so many nice things, coming to Dhammaloka Sentry, whatever it is in here. Have a cup of tea. Thank you for the tea maker. And all of these kind of things, you are really kind of pro-life. Yeah, life is marvelous. Life affirmative, or whatever they call it. And so on the one hand, so that will tend then to lead to ideas of permanence, because you're enjoying life, you like the way things are. If you hear someone gives you a doctrine of permanence, you think, yeah, permanence, wonderful, I want to hang out with God forever after. God is a nice guy, I want to hang out with God. Or a nice girl, or a nice it, I'm not sure which gender God is, but one of those three, or something else. And then you have the annihilationist view. And these are people who are often really fed up with life. Yeah, they have been living, have had a really hard time. They don't really want to carry on after they have lived this life. I remember there was one monk many years ago, he told me that he had gone back to one of his aunties and said to his auntie that, you know, you're getting old now, she was saying that, I'm getting old now, I may not have that much time left or whatever. And he said, yeah, and then of course you get reborn. And then she said, oh no, I don't want to get reborn. My life has been so hard, it's been so tough. She was probably born before the Second World War or whatever, I'm not sure. She doesn't want to get reborn. So this is not an uncommon view in humanity, this feeling of I want to everything to come to an end when I die. And of course, if that's what you want, and then someone has an annihilationist doctrine saying, well, actually when you die, that will be the end. Well, then that doctrine feels positive to you. Yeah, you feel good about that doctrine because it fits with your idea. You want to come to an end. So that's how it works. So then that view, because it suits your feelings, you take up that view. It's kind of interesting, right? How views and are so based on feelings in this way. And of course, this has kind of a lot of consequences for us when we think about our own views, that we are a bit more humble about them, we don't take them so seriously. If it all comes from feelings, if it doesn't come from any logical foundation, there's no real basis for taking those views so seriously anymore. That's kind of nice, Don't take your views so seriously. It softens everything up. It makes it more malleable, makes it more wieldy. Which is good, because we know that we have wrong view to some extent. Is anyone here who has fully right view? No? Okay, so that's good, right? So that means that if you haven't got fully right view, it means that there's always room for improvement. We need to go a bit further. There's more to be done. We're not yet stream entry. Stream entry has fully right view. Anyone prior to stream entry is already going to have some kind of wrong view. So we need to always approach, get closer to right view. So if you accept that, it means you take your own views less seriously as well, which is great. This is where these things come from. At least in part, there is obviously some degree of logic as well. It can be deduced logically. There's many different ways of arriving at these views, but ultimately it comes down to feelings. Even logic is very often based on feelings ultimately, because logic is, depends on your assumptions, depends on all kind of things. It is not just a foolproof system. Yes. Yeah.
I just want to get it clear, that's all.
Yeah.
Right? Not to...
Good, please.
Just to get it clear.
Absolutely.
So, is the exertion that there is currently an existing being, and then after some time, it goes to complete annihilation?
When you die, yeah.
Or that the assertion even challenged that existing being does not exist in the first place.
No, it says specifically, there it says annihilation, eradication, and obliteration of an existing being. Yeah.
So the being exists.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. So there is, all of these views are based on the existence of some being, because that comes from the sense of self. Okay, so they argue this point on seven grounds. Sorry about that. Okay, so here we are. So let's have a look at these grounds one after the other. This is the first one. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who have this doctrine and view. The self is physical. made up of the four primary elements and produced by mother and father. Since it is annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up, it does not exist after death. That is how this self becomes rightly annihilated. This is how some assert the annihilation of an existing being. So this is basically taking the physical body as yourself. Which is kind of curious when you think about it. It is not a very natural thing to do, because the physical body, we see it kind of, there's obviously a mental part to life, so it's a little bit strange. But that's kind of, I guess that's still what people do. So this self is physical. Pali word is rupi. Rupi means that it has form. Form of some kind. It doesn't necessarily mean material. It can mean that, but doesn't have to mean that. It is made up of the four great elements. Earth, water, air, and fire. These are the ancient primordial elements of all human culture. If you go around the world, it was found pretty much everywhere. The basis of, any material things were said to be these four elements before they had the periodic table and that sort of stuff. And produced by mother and father. That's pretty obvious. And so this is this self. It's annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up, does not exist after death. So this is kind of pretty obvious, because if you take the body as the self, then obviously you have a problem when the body dies. It's going to end. There is no two ways about that. There's one little interesting point I want to kind of make here. This is the idea that the body is produced by mother and father. Because this is basically like modern genetics, inheritance. You get the DNA from your mum, you get the DNA from your dad, and somehow they get merged, and then you have your new DNA as a person. So it's like, it's basically kind of what we would expect in the present day. And other places in the suttas, you find this interesting idea that you have, on the one hand, you have the physical body, just like here, four primary elements produced by mother and father. That is the physical part of existence. And the mental part of existence is the consciousness of the mind, which is bound to that physical body. And that is actually a very... So this shows you that in Buddhism, we are dealing with almost like two separate entities. On the one hand, we have the physical body, which then must be subject to the law of genetics. The law of natural selection, Darwinism, all these kind of things. Because that's what physical things do. And then the consciousness is kind of separate from that, and it kind of gets bound to this body in one life. And then in the next life, it may go on and be bound to something else. Or it may have a mind-made body, or a perception-made body. There's all kinds of possibilities. But the consciousness, the mind, is one thing, and the physical body is something else. This is not what they're saying here. This is what they're saying elsewhere in the sutta. That's why I'm trying to make this point. So you have two kind of different laws. One is the law of natural selection, the law of genetic mutations and these kind of things that drives the process of natural selection on the one hand. On the other hand, you have the consciousness, which of course is run by the laws of karma, the laws of action, mental action. So the consciousness has one kind of evolution, and the physical phenomena, material phenomena, have another kind of evolution. And then these two streams of evolution, they meet in any particular life. That seems to be what is going on here. People often ask, is Buddhism compatible with natural selection? And the answer is yes, because this is what we see here. It is precisely because the body is considered like a separate thing from consciousness, and consciousness can carry on from that body after you die. Two separate things with two different evolutions, if you like. That's kind of interesting. So I think that makes it very clear that Buddhism is actually quite compatible with natural selection. There isn't any problem there. They are just two different streams. And in Buddhism you have this additional evolution. That's the evolution of the mind, which then comes through making karma and how we live our lives. Purifying yourself and all of these kind of things. Is that interesting? It's pretty cool, pretty neat. Anyway, So that is the how it works. And now there is a lot of interesting kind of philosophical implications of this, because what exactly is that mind, yeah, that we're talking about, which comes together with the material body? Is it completely different from the material body, or does it have some of the characteristics of the material? And these are kind of some of these philosophical questions about dualism that is, you know, commonly talked about in philosophical circles, the idea that you cannot have two completely different things that somehow working together, because there's no way they can actually act together. I don't think this is really that kind of dualist perspective. I think the mind here already has some kind of material properties to it, and then it meets these other material properties, and then they somehow work together. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that because it gets too far astray. Yes, please.
Can I ask, where does the conscious and the subconscious fit into this?
Where does subconsciousness fit in?
The subconscious and the conscious.
Yeah. Well, I think the subconscious would be considered part of the conscious. Because consciousness here is consciousness in the broadest kind of way. And I know that there are many people who argue that there isn't really anything that is really subconscious. It is conscious in a very limited, much more limited way. But everything that is subconscious actually is conscious, but in a way whereby you can't access it very easily, for example. That's why it's called subconscious. It's not unconscious. Yeah, subconscious means like below consciousness. So I think it still has a conscious nature, but a more refined one. And that's what most Buddhists would argue, that that's, you know, you cannot have anything conscious, you can't have subconscious things in Buddhism. Everything is experienced in a certain way. Yeah. All right. So the body, when you die, it's annihilated. Yeah, kind of makes sense. This is how some assert the annihilation of an existing being. Yeah. Okay. But someone else says to them, that self of which you speak does exist. I don't deny it. But that's not how this self becomes rightly annihilated. There is another self that is divine, physical, sensual, consuming solid food. You don't know or see that, but I know it and see it. Since this self is annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up and doesn't exist after death, that is how this self becomes rightly annihilated. That is how some assert the annihilation of an existing being. So, what is going on here? So the idea here is that the body is not the end of the matter. There is also a self that is divine, so this would mean like maybe a mind-made body, yeah? Something more refined than what we normally think about. And it's physical here, it doesn't mean physical in the ordinary sense, it means more something that has form, yeah? Because even in the heavenly realms, devalokas, you have things have form, they still have some kind of material aspect to them. This is the idea of physical. Sensual just here means that it's part of the sensory realm. You still have senses, you can still sense the world. And consuming solid food means that you are still eating. Yeah, you're not just feeding on joy, which you are in the really high realms, but there's still kind of an intake of external food. That's really what it means. The point is that even if the body dies, there is that more refined self within. But that refined self, which is not the same as the physical body, it depends on the physical body. So when the physical body dies, that refined self also dies, because it depends on the physical body. So it's like, you know, you have a mind, yeah? If you have a mind, they will say the mind depends on the physical body. So when the physical body dies, then the mind dies. Very similar to what many people today would say, atheist circles and neuroscientists perhaps, and these sort of people. Yeah, so that's really the difference between this one and the previous. So not much difference. Yeah, you both die, finish, everything is annihilated when you die. Yeah? But the self is slightly made up in a slightly different way. Yeah? Okay, next one. Yeah? But someone else says to them, that self of which you speak does exist. I don't deny it. But that's not how this self becomes rightly annihilated. There is another self that is divine, physical, mind-made, complete in all its various parts, not deficient in any faculty. You don't know or see that, but I know it and see it. Since this self is annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up and doesn't exist after death, that is how this self becomes rightly annihilated. This is how some assert the annihilation of an existing being. So here we go to something even more refined. Yeah, we're moving up in the refinement here from one kind of being to another. And here the mind is even more kind of refined. But even this more refined mind is tied up with the body. So when the body dies, the mind also comes to an end because it is tied up with the body. Again, just like, you know, many people would say in modern, modern atheists or whatever. Yeah. So what exactly is this self? This is kind of an interesting self. Again, it's divine. Yeah, it belongs to the heavenly. What is the Pali word? Sagga. Saggika? I'm not sure. Physical again. Rupa, in other words, it has form, yeah, not physical in the ordinary sense. I don't really fully agree with the translation physical here, but having form is more kind of appropriate. Mind-made, what does that mean? And this is kind of an interesting term. Mind-made means mano-maya. Mano is the mind, maya means made. So what do we mean by mind-made? It could have, theoretically, two kinds of meanings. It could mean made by mind, or it could mean made of mind. And I usually read this, and I thought, well, it means made by mind. Yeah, a body made by mind. It doesn't really, here it has a self made by mind. But in other places, they talk about the manomaya kaya, the body made by mind. That's what it sounds like, how we can read it. But actually, it doesn't really make sense, because this idea of being made by mind, or made, there's another one, sanya maya, which would then mean made by perception, as if the physical body is created by the mind. Well, when it comes to being created by perception, these are the immaterial attainments. You cannot have a physical body created in those realms. So what I'm saying is that this idea of mind made by mind doesn't actually make any sense. Made of mind and then made of perception is actually sensible because it fits the context of these words. Yeah, so you have the body made of mind. It's a mental body in its own right. And this is actually very fascinating. This is one of those very tricky words to understand in the Pali Canon. This is the word kaya, which is usually translated as body. Yeah, but you can see here what it means. It's not body in any ordinary sense. It means the mental, the mind itself. The body made of mind. If the body is made of mind, well, it actually means that that's all you have is a mind. There is no physical body apart from that. And what that means is that when we translate a word like kaya, this is one of those very controversial topics in Buddhism, and people argue on the internet, don't go there, don't go to those arguments, stay away. You're not going to get any wiser by going there. Argue endlessly about what this means, and then you get this kind of, they talk about the kind of the wars, yeah, we all know that you have wars on the internet. These are kind of the Dhamma wars, yeah. You are in one Dhamma camp, another Dhamma camp, and they get out the verbal daggers, and they stab each other with verbal daggers. Yeah, that's actually an expression from the sutta, they're stabbing each other with verbal daggers, and that's exactly what we do. We hurt each other with our words. So this is a very controversial topic, and for that reason it's very interesting to kind of have some feeling for what this means. So especially when it comes to things like the jhana states, what do they mean? It says there that you experience the jhana state kayena, literally, you could say with the body, right? But if you experience the jhana state with body, doesn't that mean you have to have the body present in the jhana states? Well, actually, no, because kaya, as we see here, can mean the body made of mind. So it's a mental body. It doesn't mean the physical body in these things. It actually means a mental body. So a mental body is just whoever you are in that state. Yeah, that's your mental body. Whoever you are, your personality, your being in those states. This is what monks do. Yeah, we kind of investigate these kind of things. Maybe you find it really weird, but actually, you know, if you're going to have a good argument with somebody, you have to argue these issues, because otherwise you don't understand things properly. And this matters enormously, because the state of samadhi, where you can feel the body, is actually a very shallow state of samadhi. If the body is still there, you haven't gone very deep. So if you interpret that as jhana, you have a very big problem of interpretation. But if the body is completely gone, it's a far more profound statement. Far more profound state, when you cannot access the body anymore. There's no senses and nothing like that. So the interpretation, the very understanding of things like jhana state, samadhi, achieving the deathless and these kind of things, actually hinges on a correct interpretation of words like body, or kaya, words like kaya. And the more you read the suttas, it's very obvious to me that kaya does not mean physical body. It's a very superficial analysis of that word. And only when you really read the suttas very carefully do you understand that actually it is much, much broader. In many places, you actually find things like the namakaya and rupakaya. Rupakaya means the form body, namakaya means the mental body, as distinguished from each other. You have sakkaya ditti, the view of an existing body. It is defined in terms of the five khandhas, which include mental qualities, must refer to mental qualities. In the case of the third jhana, which is kayena sukhang patisangvedi, which means experiencing happiness with the body, if you translate it the classical way, actually a much better translation would be to personally experiencing happiness, or directly experiencing happiness. Then you're getting closer to the actual meaning here. That is the idea of kaya. I'm saying this because actually it is very important to get these things right. We misinterpret the whole Dhamma and the path of samadhi based on very simple things like that. And you will be surprised how much typing on the computers is wasted because of these kind of issues. Please.
I just want to check with you, because it's obviously very clear that among us here, it's taken to be for granted that there's consciousness and there's the body, the material body, the physical universe. There's also the consciousness. Mm. Of course, just among this community.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say in the bigger community. Yeah. But if that were to be the case, obviously we take it for granted here. Now, if of course we also take it for granted that samadhi exists, right? Deep samadhi does exist.
Mm.
Yeah. And what you have asserted just now is that when that happens, when that state exists, or when that state is realized, the mind is completely cut off from the physical universe, right?
Yeah.
So and it's quite clear from some texts here and earlier texts. It states that they also accept the states whereby the physical universe neither exists nor non-exists. Right? There are some parts.
It's not the eternal
binary logics. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah.
And because that appears to me to be very very prescient and very very forward-looking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it is actually possible, even in the modern science, if we do accept this assumption from the modern scientific view, because if the mind does cut off from the physical universe, then during that stage, the mind actually neither exists nor non-exists, because the wave function does not collapse, because there's no observer.
Hmm.
So I just want to check if that is what we mean here. because the understanding here is that it's a hotly debated topic, actually.
Yeah.
It's moved on. It's moved on from the absolute wrong view that we have formed, just become compost and so on, and the elemental particles.
Yeah.
It's moved on already. That belongs to old school thought.
Yeah.
That they actually start to accept consciousness does exist,
basically. Right. Yeah.
And it's quite clear that because if it's not observing something, that something neither exists nor non-exists. It's also accepted. And if that were to be the case, if we do claim that we can detach, and it's all over the sutta, then indeed, during that period, say a few hours or a few days, the whole universe neither exists nor non-exists.
Yeah, I think it is slightly different in the suttas. I think the reason why the Buddha refuses to answer those questions, that the universe is eternal or non-eternal, the universe is infinite or finite, I think those are the questions you were thinking of. Because are they going to tempt?
During that period.
Sure, but you mentioned before the questions. Yeah. 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 But remember that the point of the Buddha is that the universe is not something out there. The universe is personal. There is only one universe. That's our experience of the world. That's the real universe. That's what the Buddha says in the Rohitasa Sutta. The world is found in this fathom-long body with this consciousness. It is your experience that is important. That is the world. Anything out there is just purely hypothetical. We don't know what that is. It's in our minds that we build up a vision of the world. It's all happening within our mind. Yeah, the colors I see, the people I see, all that is an interpretation. It's a mental reality. Yeah? So we don't really know what is out there. The Buddha doesn't talk about the world out there. It's limited to our perception. Yeah? So because it's limited to our mental state, because that is the whole world, well, the world changes depending on what your mental state is. So when you go into samadhi, that is the whole world that exists at that time. Yeah? So your world, actually, that is really the whole world. We're not talking Buddhism about the world out there. And that's why this whole thing of, you know, the Schrodinger equation collapsing and this kind of stuff, it kind of becomes irrelevant from a Buddhist point of view. Huh? I'm not saying that it's wrong, but it's one limited viewpoint of the world. And the Buddhist world is just different. Yeah.
So you're saying that we should talk about I separate that from the mental side. Yeah. But
yeah.
You're saying that mental side is just one, and it is just one whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The mental side is our experience of the world. Yeah. This is our experience. What is the world apart from our experience? We can't say. It's just, you know, we don't know what it is. So it kind of becomes irrelevant. And from Buddhist point of view, it's personal experience that matters. That is considered the world.
So you're saying that is just as real inside? Of course, yeah.
That is not just as real, it's more real. That's the primary reality.
Time the whole outside thing is all gone. It's not inaccessible, right? Because we are just in the pure samadhi state. We're just with the mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So there is it's just the change of perception. Yeah. Okay, so this is the idea of mind-made. The word kaya being very important. The word kaya actually means a heap. It means a conglomeration of things. It doesn't actually have any direct reference to the body as such. It can mean physical body in certain limited contexts, but actually has a much, much broader meaning. And this is a very important thing for interpreting the suttas in the right way. I should add that question into the questionnaire for the spiritual education group, I think. Kaya, what does kaya mean in Buddhism? That's for the super advanced, the super duper advanced teachers. So that is mind-made, complete in all its various parts. Sabanga pachangi or something like that. This is like, you know, when you go into the heavenly realms, you have no defects. Yeah, you're absolutely complete. There's no defects to the body. The higher up you are in the heavenly realms, the more complete you are. Yeah, they talk about drawing the mental body out of the physical body. So you can draw another body out of this one, just like a snake shedding its old skin and coming out, or like you have a straw and you pull out the new straw from within the old one. It looks the same. Yeah, it is the same basically. In the same way, the mental body comes out of the physical body. So that's how you have an outer body experience, right? Oh, I'm still here. What happened? My body is down there. What's going on? And that experience, because that is a mental body, it is going to be much more perfect. There is no deficiency. Yeah, you can't cut off your fingers if you have a mental body, because this is no way of cutting it off. Maybe there is. Not sure. That's just making it up on the go. But maybe, yeah, anyway. So this is kind of the idea with these mental bodies, not deficient in any faculty. Ahin indriya. And faculty here refers usually to the faculties of the six senses. There's no deficiency in the six senses. And you may have heard of some of these near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. And they say it is more real than the human experience. Human experience, you come back here, it feels more like a dream. It feels more like blurry. It doesn't feel as concrete. But when you have these other experiences, it feels incredibly real. So some people who have had out-of-body or near-death experiences, they are absolutely sure that there is a continuation after death, because it's far more real. If anything is a dream, it's human experience. And the one thing after the death is the real thing. Because your faculties become incredibly sharp. This idea of ahin indriya, not deficient in your faculties. You see very clearly, everything is really, really sharp contrast in these realms. The heavenly mind-made, bodies made of mind. Please, yeah, of course, Conrad, yeah.
Does that explain the language around the first four jhanas being sort of rupa jhana?
You mean this is referring to that?
Does it explain the language of... Because the first four jhanas are known as... The four jhanas are known as rupa.
Rupa jhana, right.
And does that idea of like a mind-body explain what they're referring to there, and calling the jhanas the rupa jhanas?
I don't think so. I think this is prior to that, because complete in all its various parts, there are no various parts in the jhana state.
Just the initial idea that you talked about around there being a mind-body.
Yeah.
Does that explain... I guess rupa jhana, because I've thought about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the way that it's taught, jhana being kind of, you know, you let go of five senses.
Yeah.
So I wonder where the body comes into jhana. And if you, from what you're talking about today.
Yeah. Well,
that explains it.
Yeah. Well, it would mean that it's a body made of mind in the jhanas.
Yeah.
So your experience is your body.
Yeah.
Your experience is bliss. So the bliss is your body.
Yeah.
But there isn't any physical body, anything like that.
Yeah.
There is maybe a very slight, they call form jhanas, rupa jhanas, and that is because there may be some form left, some remainder of form left in the state, but it's not the kind of ordinary physical form, it's like it's a mental kind of aspect of form, but even that is very hard to really understand until I think you get into the formless attainments, the arupa attainments, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next one. That's only the second one. Gee, okay. But someone... Oh, that's the third one, actually. Yeah, so that's good. But someone else says to them, that self of which you speak does exist. I don't deny it. But that's not how this self becomes rightly annihilated. There is another self which has gone totally beyond perceptions of form. With the ending of perceptions of impingement, not focusing on perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, it is reborn in the dimension of infinite space. You don't know or see that, but I know it and see it. This self is annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up and doesn't exist after death. That is how this self becomes rightly annihilated, or maybe utterly annihilated might be better. That is how some assert the annihilation of an existing being. So what we have here is that you go beyond everything to do with form, yeah, and you go to the ending of perceptions of impingement. Impingement means like that relate somehow to sensory experience, because sensory experience, like you impinge, yeah, something hits the eye and then bang, you see, or something like that. It's like impingement, hitting, contact, if you like, yeah. Not focusing on perceptions of diversity. There's your mental outlook is completely unified. There's no diversity in these experiences. Aware that space is infinite, or more better maybe, space is without bounds. There are no limits to space. Infinite gives an idea that it goes on forever. That is not an experience that you can have. It is more an experience without bounds. It is reborn in the dimension of infinite space. And I don't really know why he has translated it as reborn, because it doesn't really make all that much sense in the current context, because the whole point is that when you die, then the self is annihilated. So how can you be reborn? To me, it doesn't fit the context. So I think it is more that it is related to the dimension of infinite space, or is somehow, you know, it has that quality, if you like. I think would be a better translation in this context. And I think that works with the Pali. So this is the first immaterial attainment. Yeah, you're connected with a dimension of boundless space. So here we have come to, I'll just briefly mention to you, just in connection with the idea of the word kaya, here we have gone completely beyond perceptions of form. There is no form at all in this particular state. These are called sanya maya kaya. These are bodies made of perception. In other words, your personal experience is entirely made of perception. There's no body there. And yet, the suttas say that you touch these things. Touch them, or you contact them, or you experience them, right? Kayena, with the body, if we translate it in the traditional sense. But how can you touch something with the body, which is an entirely mental experience, where all form has ceased? It's impossible. And this almost proves the point that kaya in the suttas very often does not mean physical body. It means mental body. It means your personality. It means who you are as a being. Yeah, I personally experience these things. Then it kind of makes sense. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense to anyone here. I hope so. But to me it makes a lot of sense. But anyway, I apologize for going into lots of details. Yeah. That's what it seems to mean, yeah. That's what it seems to mean. The idea is that you know that there is such a thing as the infinite space perception that you get probably through meditation, but that perception, you see it as tied up with the body. Yeah. So when the body dies, it also goes. That seems to be the point, yeah. Yes?
Ajahn, we were talking a few minutes ago about rupa and arupa jhanas.
Sorry. Yes?
And I just have a question. So, my limited experience, just asking whether rupa means when you're having those jhanas, you're experiencing your mind as the main thing, so like a light, as your mind becomes like a light.
Yeah.
Whereas in this space is infinite, it's dark, there's no light. You're not reflecting your mind. Yeah. You're the observer, and that it appears there's no light, there's no reflection of your mind.
Yeah, something like that. There is some very basic thing remaining in the jhanas, which may be light, probably something light-wise, which will not be there. But light somehow has a form to it in some way, and that's what makes it the rupa jhana. And I don't know if it is quite right to say that the immaterial attainments are dark. I don't know if they're really dark, if you know what I mean. They may not have that light in quite the same way, but they're still very powerful states of supreme mental clarity. I don't think you experience them as dark, but you experience them as extremely clear and very, very powerful, but without that kind of light source, perhaps.
And also, is that then only a portion of the kaya, the perception portion? So that if you don't have the whole of the mind kaya, that it becomes not so luminous, or it becomes a very different experience, because you don't see more non-self in the space is infinite, because you don't identify with anything.
Yeah.
Only the observation, even the observation is also cut down to perception only.
Yeah. Yes, but that is the kaya you have. That is all you have at that time. That the point is that in Buddhism, there is not, you know, what you have now. That's all there is. And so you can say that, when you go into that perception, well, that's the reality at that time. When you go into the infinite space, that is your reality. And that is all there is. When you are reborn into that realm, that's everything there is. And then when you come out of that realm, well, then you may take up other qualities again. But at that time, that's really the whole of reality. So your perception is it.
There's no thought formation. There's nothing.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Yeah.
I do have one more question.
One more question? Okay.
If that's okay.
Yeah.
Wonderfully achieved monk, and in his later years he went into a coma.
Yeah.
So I'm just then trying to think of the consciousness and the body. So the body is not working, the mind, the brain is not working, you're not able to express yourself, you're not having much sense input.
Yeah.
But your consciousness is still associated with the body, so it stays nearby and it doesn't separate from the body, or is it separate experience and they go somewhere else in the coma state?
Yeah. Not sure, because I think it really depends on the kind of illness you have, you know, whether you are still able to think and have a separate agency, whether it's only the body that is paralyzed, or whether maybe your mind is somehow, the brain is damaged, so that your mind also is kind of caught up in that problem. I would say it depends on the kind of, he had a stroke apparently, so it depends on the nature of that stroke. And usually when you have a stroke, you can still think properly, you just can't speak, you can't express yourself. And as long as he's able to think properly, well then he can go into jhana states and can do all kind of things, and you know, to alleviate any problems that he may have. But maybe certain strokes can be so severe that it is very hard to even, you lose kind of some of your self-awareness until the mind kind of releases when you die. Then of course it all comes back again. But in that meantime, it may be problematic. So I don't know. Yeah.
So life, two systems coming together.
Yeah.
But if you separate too much, then the body can't survive without that consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So he's still needs to be close by or nearby.
I think he's still trapped in the body. I think he's still trapped in the body, like for most of us. I don't think he has left the body. I think he's still kind of trapped, just like we are. Because when the stroke happens, it happens usually so fast, and bang, that's it. You know.
Then some of the monks used to do this space.
Yeah.
Go and leave the body.
So astral travel. Yeah.
Yeah. Body can survive for
yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, maybe he could do that. Yeah, quite possibly. Not sure. I haven't really. Yeah. Not entirely sure if these things are kind of very hard to know, because that will depend very much on individual circumstances. So, not sure. Yeah. All right. So let's just, before I take these online questions, let us just finish off these seven kinds of annihilation here. So it is reborn in the dimension of infinite space. So that dimension, I don't think rebirth is correct. It is just means that it is connected to the body, and then when you die, it also dies. But then someone else comes along, and they say, but someone else says to them, that self of which you speak does exist. I don't deny it. But that is not how this self becomes utterly annihilated. There is another self which has gone totally beyond the dimension of infinite space, where that consciousness is boundless. It is reborn, or it's not reborn, it is connected to the dimension of infinite consciousness. You don't know and see that, but I know it and see it. Since this self is annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up and doesn't exist after death, That is how this self becomes rightly annihilated. That is how some assert the annihilation of an existing being. So again, the idea is that it is even more refined states. Yeah, you go beyond the infinite space, you go to infinite consciousness. That too is tied up with the body, and because it's tied up with the body, when the body dies, bang, that too is gone as a consequence. More and more refined, and more hard to understand what these states are without experiencing them, of course. Next one. But someone else says to them, that self of which you speak does exist. I don't deny it. But that's not how this self becomes utterly annihilated. There is another self that has gone totally beyond the dimension of infinite consciousness. Aware that there is nothing at all. It is connected to the dimension of nothingness. You don't know or see that, but I know it and see it. Since the self is annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up and doesn't exist after death, that is how this self becomes utterly annihilated. That is how some assert the annihilation of an existing being. More and more refined, the awareness that there is nothing. How can that be? How can you be aware that there is nothing? Just try to think about that for a second, what that means. It's very hard to really understand. You are aware that there's absolutely nothing. It sounds like a disembodied awareness almost, doesn't it? But it's not, because there is still some kind of perception there. There's always some kind of perception when there is consciousness. But it's extremely refined. Please.
Be clear here, because your time is very precious.
Yeah.
Your time with me is very precious. Just to make sure I understand.
Yeah.
So, I assume this is not an academic discussion.
No, of course not. Yeah.
This must be said by someone who is a real practitioner, absolutely gifted, talented, you know, high flyer, that knows what he or she is talking. He or she actually enters into that base.
Yeah.
And just not that, like me bullshitting, you know, talking about this over a cup of coffee. You know, otherwise, just waste of everybody's time.
Yeah.
But if that would be the case, are we saying that even with that kind of high flyer, absolute high flyer here, still trapped by the view?
Yeah.
And still.
Yeah. I don't know whether it is theoretical or someone actually having this view, but obviously it is possible to have that view. That's kind of really the point, so you're quite right. It is possible to have it. And yes, they are still trapped. That's the point. Because they have a view of self. Yeah, this is kind of the point. And as long as you have that view of self, well, you're going to hold on to it in a certain way. And even the idea of annihilation is actually a projection into the future, because annihilation always happens in the future somewhere. Yeah? So it is a kind of craving that drives you into the future, just like craving for sensory things or craving for existence. It's about a future state. And for that reason, it drives on to another birth, ultimately. Underlying tendencies. The underlying tendency to I am, asmi mana nusaya, which you have there. Yeah. Let's go on to the next one. But someone else says to them, that self of which you speak does exist. I don't deny it. But that's not how this self becomes utterly annihilated. There is another self that has gone totally beyond the dimension of nothingness. Aware that this is peaceful, this is sublime. It is connected to the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. You don't know or see that, but I know it and see it. Since this self is annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up and doesn't exist after death, that is how this self becomes utterly annihilated. That is how some assert the annihilation of an existing being. So here we go to an even more refined perception. And you will notice here that this time it doesn't say aware of the perception of neither non-perception, aware of the perception of neither perception nor non-perception. Yeah, in all the previous one, you were aware of infinite space, you were aware of infinite, you were aware of nothingness. But here, you're not aware of the or the name of this attainment. Rather, you're just aware that this is peaceful and sublime. It is so refined, you can't really get your handle on this perception. It is so refined, you can't really know what it is, except that you know it's delightful and refined. This is how powerful these things become. It becomes inconceivable unless you actually have some experience like this. But this, even this super-duper refined state is somehow tied to the body, tied up with the body. And for that reason, is it annihilated and destroyed when the body breaks up? The seventh kind of annihilation. Let's just have a quick look at the summarizing at the end here. These are the seven grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins assert the annihilation, eradication, and obliteration of an existing being. And the ascetics and Brahmins who assert the annihilation, eradication, obliteration of an existing being do so on one or other of these seven grounds. Outside of this, there is none. The realized one understands this, and those who genuinely praise the realized one would rightly speak of these things. Yeah, because again, this deals with the only way you can understand these things is by understanding non-self, understanding dependent origination, the very core of the Dhamma. That is the only way. So this is how you rightly praise the realized one, the Buddha, in other words, because he has broken out of those ordinary views of the world and seen something which is extraordinarily profound and different from what is basically seen by anyone else in human history. This is how the Buddha defines what is difference between his teaching and any other teaching, is precisely the insight into non-self. Alright, so let me stop there for a while. I don't know exactly how long, but let's have a look at the questions that have come in. Only one question it seems. Or many questions. Okay, a few questions here. Alright. So, first one is maybe from India. It starts off with Namaste, so maybe that's the reason. No self-fact destroys interest in life and leads to dullness, irritation, etc. What is the value of life, Ajahn? Okay, I see. You think if there's no self, it kind of makes everything dull and boring or whatever and makes it really bad. But no, not really, because the whole point of the Buddhist teaching, yeah, is that there is no self right now. And you are still capable of joy, of happiness, of deep meditation, all of these kind of things. That's kind of the Buddhist idea. So it doesn't mean that it is makes life dull or boring. On the contrary, it makes it very exciting. Yeah. Sometimes the sense of self can get in the way of spiritual progress. Because if you have an idea of a self, it's like a barrier. It's like a permanent essence within you that you cannot go beyond. That's kind of the idea of a permanent essence. You can't go beyond it. So in one way, you can say that you are trapped by having a permanent essence. We'll see later on in the sutta that there are people or beings who think that the five senses are the greatest happiness. Yeah, oh, I'm indulging the five senses. Yeah, this is it. This is nirvana, they say. Right? But that doesn't really, not the Buddhist kind of idea. And because you think that that is yourself, if you really think that, you will never go beyond those five senses. You will be trapped by the body with all the downsides of the body as it gets old and painful and dodgy and all these kind of things. And so, actually, it can be the self-view can be a trap. Yeah, the fact that you don't really understand the potential for spiritual development. This is actually a very interesting insight, the idea that if you have a sense of self, it's very difficult to see, understand what is possible on the spiritual path. It's hard to imagine what it is like to achieve a jhana state where the bliss is so strong that you don't know what to do with yourself. Yeah, I can't take it any longer, as Ajahn Brahm Sambha. This is just too much. But of course, it isn't too much. It's just right. But that's what it can feel like sometimes. And so, sometimes the sense of self can get in the way of these things. That is the whole point. But the main point is that, what we want to do, we want to see things in accordance with reality. That's the main thing. If you don't see things in accordance with reality, if you think there is a self when in fact there is not, you're not going to be able to make good decisions about anything because you have wrong view. How can you make good decisions about anything if you have the wrong idea of the world? If you think there is a self, okay, well, then you're going to do all those things that are going to reify the self. Yeah, the self is important, going to unify with God and all of that. But if that turns out to be wrong, you're going to be in big trouble when you die here. Who knows what's going to happen? Yeah, God will forgive me. I can make a few mistakes. Actually, try to avoid those mistakes much better. So the problem is that if we have wrong view about reality, we are not capable of making good decisions. If you have right view, then you can make right decisions. So if you have doubts about the Buddhist idea of non-self, that's fine. Of course you can have doubts. Everyone has doubts every now and again, and it's a fair thing that we have, fair enough that we have doubts. But don't be sure about yourself, because these things are very uncertain. And I have made the points many times that the idea of a permanent God or a creator God is not something you can ever experience. Permanence is not an experience you can have as a human being. So when we say that there is a permanent God out there, or a God beyond time, or however you like to phrase it, actually that is not within your experience. You're not capable of such an experience. So the idea of a permanent God, because we cannot experience it, it must be a mind-made idea. Yeah, so the idea of permanent God is mind-made. It's created by human beings. It's obvious when you think about it. Because you cannot experience such a thing, it must ultimately come back to a mind-made idea. Yeah, and so there's good grounds to being a little bit skeptical about permanent gods and eternal beings and these kind of things. Because actually it doesn't make much sense from a rational point of view. So just be open, see where this takes you. And of course the point of the Buddhist path is that even understanding non-self a little bit. How do you understand non-self a little bit? Well, if you become more peaceful in your meditation, yeah, you're calming down, there is less self there. The self expresses itself through thinking, through verbalizing, through attaching to things in the world. So if you withdraw, if you calm down, you have less sense of self, actually, because there's less things going on in your mind. How does that feel? It feels incredibly nice. Yeah, when your mind is peaceful, when there's a bit of bliss coming up maybe inside, it's beautiful. You know, it's far, far superior to any ordinary state of mind you have when you're running in around the world, exerting your will, doing this, doing that, thinking about all kinds of stuff. Far superior to that. So less self is better. That's one thing you start to see. And that kind of gives you an idea that if you extrapolate, if you go beyond this as far as you possibly can, it's going to be even better. Ultimately leading to the idea of no self entirely. And that is one of the most blissful experiences you can have on the Buddhist path. Seeing that actually I was wrong all along. There never was a self there. Nothing is being destroyed. I'm just seeing reality for the first time. Hooray, no self. What a wonderful thing. That's really the truth of it. So instead of leaning to meaninglessness, it leads to profound meaning. It is one of the most wonderful things you can possibly do, is to see these kind of things. So no, it does not lead to irritation. Yeah, it only leads to irritation if you're holding on to the idea of a self. Of course, if anyone who is holding on to the idea of a self, and then someone tells them there is no self, then yes, sure, it can lead to irritation. But what are we looking for? Are we looking for truth or looking for comfort? Anyway, next one. Location unknown. The idea of non-self is very hard to grasp for me. Any practice other than meditation you can recommend to help? Just as I said just now, the idea is that you can understand a lot about non-self through meditation practice, because when you become more peaceful, there's less self there. The deeper the peace, the less the self. If you get into a state of full samadhi, where there's no movement of the mind whatsoever, the whole idea of the self being the doer disappears. If there's no movement of the mind, and you are still present, but you can't do anything, well then the idea of doing obviously cannot be who you are. And that is a very, very profound experience, because we identify so much with the doer. We are the doers in the world. Many people are very powerful doers. They always do, 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 and they feel alive through the act of doing, because that kind of reinforces their sense of self, which I take to be the doer. So by calming down the doer, you're eliminating a very large part of the sense of self. So just go with the meditation and see how beautiful it is, yeah, when the self starts to disappear. And then you start to realize that this is something very marvelous going on by letting go of this irritant inside, which is always leading you in the wrong direction. That's what the sense of self does, always leading you astray, leading you to things that lead to suffering rather than to happiness. So non-self is not mysterious at all. It's hard to grasp, but this is what you're experiencing right now. This is really non-self. Every experience is an experience of non-self. It's just that we add something to it. And that addition that we add to it, that is the problem. But really, there is no self there. Imagine sometimes, some days, when you don't think too much, you're kind of moving through life like what they call flow. Yeah, you're just moving without really having to reflect on what you're doing. Your mind is just aware. Sometimes people have these experiences, like good sports people can have them or whatever, and everyone may have them every now and again. And at that point, there's no real thinking going on, a movement going on. It's a kind of strong feeling of non-self. Yeah, because you're just moving, you're just going along. There's no pushing or pulling or anything like that. So you can have this experience more or less until it becomes incredibly profound, and then you eliminate this view once and for all. Yes.
Probably a really silly question, but where does the ego and all of that fit into this?
That's it. Sense of self, ego.
Self is the
same
ego.
Thing. Yeah, yeah, same thing. Yeah, yeah. The ego is a very coarse manifestation of the sense of self, because the ego is often very kind of, at least how we use it, kind of ordinary discourse, we use it as a very coarse thing, the ego, yeah, the kind of me, whatever it is. But these ideas of self can be incredibly refined. Like we talk about the conceit, I am. The very idea, I am, is a conceit, according to Buddhism. So the ego tends to be something more developed usually. But it's the same thing. It's all part of the same thing. Yeah. Yeah. Location unknown. Usually that means they're hanging around Dhammaloka somewhere and they don't want to show up, and so they kind of hang out the back here, and location unknown. And they send questions. That's okay. We don't mind that. Actually, next one is from Nolamara. Okay, cool. Okay. What is the origin of samsara? Why is there something instead of nothing here? So the origin of samsara, remember, samsara is really our personal samsara. Yeah, samsara is within you. This is samsara you're experiencing right now. Samsara is not the world outside. Samsara is not the universe kind of expanding or contracting. Or maybe it is, but it is the personal experience of those things that is samsara. The samsara is just life. Yeah, right. You die and you get reborn and you carry on and you get reborn in one realm, another realm, and you kind of, wandering aimlessly around, roaming around, as it's so beautifully translated in some of the suttas. That is samsara. It's your inner life. That's samsara. Why is there something rather than nothing? And that the reason for that is because of craving. Craving is what perpetuates samsara, which makes it ever existing. And the way for there to be nothing is to end craving, and then you have nothing here. So craving is the driving force, and the craving itself is rooted in ignorance or delusion. So you can argue these two things together are the cause of why there is something rather than nothing here. And nothing here doesn't mean the experience of nothing. It means no experience at all. Everything comes to an end. Okay, from Nola Mara. Dear Ajahn, based on your discussion of the word kaya, could we generalize kaya even in human animal form to mean body created of mind, resulting from sensory input? Coming back to Chattaro Mahabhutta Upadhyaya Rupa, apologies if I got that wrong. Does this mean that Rupa in itself is created of the mind by taking up of the sense input? There are so many interesting philosophical questions about what the world is actually made of. And the Buddha said, don't think about those things. That's really what he said, right? Remember the very famous simile of the Buddha where he takes up this handful of leaves in the Gosinga wood. He says to the monks, you know, you see the leaves in my hand? Yes, sir, we see your hand. Well, which are more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves overhead in the canopy overhead? And the monk says, yeah, the leaves overhead are more. Very obliging monks. So they, yeah, obviously. And then the Buddha says, well, what I have taught you and what I know is just the same thing. What I have taught you is what the leaves in my hand, and what is overhead is what I know. And so the Buddha is very pragmatic. He doesn't teach us about philosophy, because philosophy goes on forever. You can argue forever about that. So what happens? As soon as the Buddha dies, they get into philosophy. Because it's like a human attraction. We are attracted to these things. Yeah, our minds are restless or whatever. We are attracted to philosophy. We want to do these things. We think, yeah, the Buddha didn't really fill in all the gaps, so we need to fill in all the gaps so we get a complete picture of the world. But maybe there is a reason why the Buddha didn't fill in the gaps. Yeah, there could be, maybe that's a good idea not to try to fill in all the gaps, because maybe it is impossible, or maybe it will lead to all kinds of arguments, or maybe it just is a waste of time, or whatever. And if then you look at Buddhist history, they kind of create the Abhidhamma, which really is, to me, philosophy. It's a philosophical work that tries to fill in all the gaps of early Buddhism. And then you have the Mahayana schools, like Chitra Maya school, which means mind-only school. And the idea that, again, the world is really made up of mind. So the question you have here is the kaya in any human animal, could that also mean body created by mind? And it could mean that, yeah? But it's a philosophical question. Is this body here also made by mind in a certain way or a certain fashion? Maybe it is. But I don't know what the answer is. And the answer probably doesn't matter. And sometimes if we get into these philosophical discussions, we kind of can become very, very problematic and very hard to know what is up and down and left and right and black and white, etc. And we get trapped into this endless cycle of philosophy. But it's possible. I just don't know. Location unknown. When we fall asleep, does our consciousness disappear? No, it is still there. And the reason you know it is there is because if someone pokes you on the arm, you wake up. Yeah, if your consciousness was not there, you wouldn't wake up. You wouldn't feel anything. Yeah. So the consciousness is still there. It just goes into a very low state. And yeah. From Indonesia, Ajahn, is the animita stillness of the mind, meditation, connected with the arupa jhanas? That way, the arupa jhanas is kind of easier to understand. I don't know if this view is correct. It seems to be a separate stillness of mind. Yeah, it's animita seems to be different from animita samadhi, different from the material attainments. The animita samadhi is that there is no sense of permanence. Yeah, animita is a characteristic or a quality of something. Yeah? So the idea here is that it doesn't have any qualities, and quality is what gives something its essence or definition. It has these qualities, so therefore this is what it is. But if something is seen as not actually having any real qualities because it's always changing, how can something which is always changing have any qualities? It doesn't make any sense to talk about qualities anymore. The moment you see things that are always changing, it loses its sense of quality, and for that reason it loses its sense of permanence. There's this endless movement of things, moving all the time. This is the idea of animita samadhi, as I understand it anyway. And when you come out of animita samadhi, then they say you are a noble person, because that insight into impermanence is so profound that you cannot avoid being noble when you come out. You're an Arya Pugala, as it says in the suttas. So I don't think it is the same. So that is how I understand that. All right, I was hoping to come to the end of this sutta, but I don't think I should finish it off, because we're going to be here for a long time. It's already been an hour and a half. Are there any final questions or comments on this before we call it a day? Yes? Okay.
If I may, so I'm just wondering about the time of the Buddha in the Rose Apple Land. So many practitioners, different religions, but achieving very high things.
Yeah.
And I'm also my own confusion I'm trying to settle. That's why I'm asking this question. So the concept of once returner, non-returner. So some of these people must be going to different realms.
To what? To realms?
Realms.
Yeah, yeah.
So my question is, we are very lucky that Buddha was born 2,500 years ago.
Yeah.
We know the land he's born in. We can go and walk there. Are there times when these ones return and non-returners go somewhere, but they have to wait for the next Buddha, and it is a long time, eons of time, before they are what seems like permanency, if you had the wrong view? Are these realms... there, and then you had to wait for some sort of conditioning to arrive, like a Buddha or something else, for you to then get Nibbana?
I don't think there's any. I don't think you had to wait for the next next Buddha. you have already set into motion the causes that lead to the ending of everything, so you don't really need a Buddha anymore. You have right view deep down, but you have to kind of make the processes, allow the process to work itself out. It just takes a certain amount of time for the process to work itself out, and it's true, some of those realms that you might get reborn in, they will feel like you're permanent. Yeah, this is one of those strange things. You read the suttas and you see the Brahma or the Devas have been there for so long, and then the Buddha comes along and says, actually, you guys, you're impermanent. They say, what? We're impermanent? They've been there for so long, they can't remember being reborn into that realm anymore. Yeah, that's kind of, can you imagine, it's kind of very satisfying, maybe. Yeah, we are here permanent, and there's no change, and someone comes and tells you, you're going to die one day. You can imagine the fear that arises. And where you're going to be reborn, is that like very, very unsure. So I think some of those realms have that kind of feeling of permanence, but... if you're an Arya, I don't think you will buy into that. You will know what's going on there. Yeah. Yeah, Conrad. Yeah, that's what they all said. Just a quick one. No.
It was based on a question that came up for me when I first sat down around annihilation and Nibbana. And I think I've kind of answered it through listening today. But the idea of annihilationism that we're talking about depends on there being a self first. Yeah?
Yeah.
That answers my question.
Yeah.
What I was thinking was, how would you differentiate Nibbana and annihilationism?
Yeah.
Nibbana
maybe
it's not relevant if it sort of depends on the notion of there being a self. Because I guess Nibbana is kind of the ending, isn't it?
It is. It is an ending. And that's kind of the difference. It's an ending. One thing is an annihilation. One is an ending. It's like you stop work, Nibbana. That's kind of Nibbana of work. So this is Nibbana in a slightly bigger context. But really what it is, it's the ending of dukkha. That's what it really is. So you can't really go wrong. You end suffering. You end problems. And hello, happiness. So it's kind of a good deal, as I say. Yeah. So this is kind of very interesting. It's just a tiny change in perception as to what it means makes all the difference. Because it's very hard for people to get their heads around cessation and annihilation. And it sounds like it is the same, but actually there's a vast difference because one seems scary, while the other one seems actually the opposite of scary. It's actually really happy.
Thanks.
Oh, okay. What happened? This is something else, is it? There we are. Okay, everyone, that's it for today. So let's just pay respect to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.